Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. For the very best in alternative media, go to the commonsprojectnetwork.com. Hello, I am Ruth Ann Amarte Fields. This is Gather Round. And our first guest, as always, is Monique Johnson. We're very fortunate because Monique has a lot of tea talks already on YouTube. And tonight we're going to use one of those because she is at a meeting and couldn't make it in. So this one is called Be True to Yourself and Your Journey of Life.
Welcome to this morning's Tea Talk. My name is Monique Johnson with Healthy Movements International. Today's Tea Talk is brought to you by a ginger black breakfast tea. And if you can see on there, sending a shout out to Minnesota. Hello, y'all. Cheers. I love that. Ginger black breakfast. I have a little hazelnut cream. I put a little stevia in it, but it really didn't need it. It's a little oversweet. So, anyway, happy September! If you know a little bit about me, August is my month to bring in kind of all of my energies. It just so happens to be the natural thing that happens with me. And a lot of times I bring it all in and I see that the journey has me focus it out to certain ones individually, or it'll have me bring it all in and just kind of reassess, recoup, and gives me an opportunity to make sure I'm staying authentic and true to myself. So the subject that's on my heart today is just that, authenticity and being true to one's self. So the benefit of having this life tool is that as life, if you decide to allow life to kind of move you into the healthiest spot for you, to kind of guide you through picking up the pieces that you've left behind, that you've tucked away of yourself, kind of guide you through healing some of the pains and wounds of life that you have yet to deal with. If at any point you decide to allow that to be how you move through your journey of life, then a tool that is very connected to that is being authentic and staying true to yourself. When this tool showed itself to be the most beneficial for me many times, I remember even when I was like, I guess I left home about 16, my mom's house at 16, and part of that was really staying authentic to myself. I knew that situation was not healthy for me, even though if I look around and all my fellow 16-year-olds were staying in their mama's house and putting up and dealing with and just, you know, that was right for them, apparently. It was not right for me. So, and it wasn't healthy for me. So I had to face my fears. The fear of being alone, the fear of not being able to do it, to make it and survive at 16 on my own, the fear of not having the support of ones that I had gotten acclimated to counting on. Rather, it was because my home life was not it was abusive. It was an abusive home. But there was some comfort in that abuse because I could rely on it. So I really did have to face my fears in order to live authentically and to let go. So know, I remember that was one of the first times that that tool kind of showed up, and I wasn't conscious of it at that time. Then you skip quite a decade or so, and another time it showed up is that one of the reasons why I left home at 16 was because it was a very abusive household, and we were raised in a fundamentalist religion that kind of was the umbrella by which all abuses took place. So I left at home at 16. Life really told me it was time and that I needed to do that, no matter how much I was afraid. And fear hasn't really played a large part in my actions, I don't think, in that part of life. So 26 came around, and I was being felt that life was pushing me back to that religion. And I was a little weirded out by that, because my own judgments of right, wrong, good, bad, should, shouldn't was like I was never going to be a part of that religion again. However, there was a higher purpose at work, and that was for me to heal. I had done all that I could up to that point to kind of heal my past and the choices I had made and the choices that I had allowed to be made for me, and the choices that I was so young that I really couldn't have a different experience. I had did all I could to heal all of that by the time I was about 26. And at about 26, my journey started pushing me back toward that religion, and I was like, oh, my God, surely not. But it did, and I acquiesced to the flow of life, not to the flow of humans and what they wanted me to do or what another person said was should be or should not. I acquiesced to the flow of life, and then there were certain beings that were in my life that supported me acquiescing to the flow of life. So I went back into that church, and hindsight told me that it really was about me getting close to my mom to heal my mother issues. Even though I would not have chosen that path, it really was the most healthy and the only path available, even though it was the harder one, for me to heal those wounds as quick as possible. And I was past time of wanting to stagnate in the journey, so I went in and I did it. There were a few knocks on the doors when I could have gotten out of that, but I stayed in to the point that it became very painful to get out. But what got me out again was coming back to the light tool of being authentic and being true to myself and my journey of life. That's what moved me out of the religion. It's actually what moved me into the religion, too. So it's funny, as your perspective becomes broader and broader, and you're able to see the tools and the dots of life, then you can start to connect them to see, that's what that was about, and that's what that was about. In the moment, you may not always know what it's about. And that's why the life tool of trusting the journey is so important. Not trusting other people and da-da-da. You can do that too. But allow your greatest empowerment to be your ability to feel the flow of your journey and to trust that. Being okay with letting go of all the concepts of right and wrong that you thought were your guiding force. Because as the journey starts to move you, you don't move by the same guiding forces anymore. The brain gets very good at being able to determine what's right and what's wrong, what should be and what should not be, what you should do and what you should not do. And it uses things like guilt, shame, and blame in order to find those boundaries. And that is moving, living outside to closer in, further in and further in. Once you're able to touch in, and how you know you have touched in is you can look out in your journey and you'll be like, oh, I see that the journey is not saying do that. I don't know how I see, I don't know how I know, but I know that is not compatible with what my journey is moving me toward. So that's when you start to see, oh, I've connected to the inside guider, inside internal teacher, inside path. Healthy path for my life. And once you have touched that, then that's when the tool of kind of letting go of driving the journey, okay? Because the journey begins to drive itself. And all you really have to do is be soft enough to the movements of the journey. For me, the journey always brought in ones who could see the path enough or who could support me in walking that path. I didn't have to have them, and I didn't need to take advantage of that little jewel that the journey was providing me. But what if I chose to? When I did choose to, it really kind of helped me to feel soothed in the journey and whatever life was having me do. It gave me help and support. For me personally, that's what I always was open to and called out to my journey of life, is bring me help, support, and clarity. And so that is what's kind of on my mind. As it relates to the energy centers and the chakras, that being authentic and living your truth and living whatever your journey is having you do, it's talking about the fifth chakra, okay? And that chakra is being able to live your truth, to speak it clearly, and not to be moved off of your own personal truth because of external situations or external people. It brings to mind one of the quotes at that time that was very dear to me was by Dr. Seuss. I'll see if I can remember it. It says something like, speak how you feel, say your truth, speak how you feel, live your truth, or whatever. And it goes on to say that because those who mind you speaking your truth and living your truth, they don't matter. And those who matter, they don't mind you speaking and living your truth. And so that Dr. Seuss quote was like my guiding light for a moment. And it's funny, it was Dr. Seuss because I always had looked at things like Bibles and religious books for my guidance. But then the journey of life started allowing and providing life itself in any given moment to give me what I need to live my healthy path. So that's this morning's Tea Talk. I'm very excited that it is September. I know time is very relative to me, and at a certain mindset, it doesn't even exist. But for whatever reason, my August to September can be a huge change that I go through. So have a beautiful day. Always remember that no matter what choices you make in life, that you are beautiful. Okay, and that rather your choices are very able to be seen how they're healthy or not, you're still beautiful. And whenever life gives you an exit ramp off of your ever circling the journey and doing the same things over and creating the same situations over and over and over, whenever life gives you an exit ramp out of that, you can choose to take it or you can choose not to. And either decision you make, you're still beautiful. The beautiful thing about life is it gives us whispers. It knocks on the front door and gives us hands to say, hey, walk this way. And there seems to be a point in life that after all of its whispers, after all of its soft ways of inviting you into your healthy journey, if you don't take it and it really is your intention somewhere, even unconsciously, to live a healthy journey, then life will break you down. And life will say, okay, you have no more choices. Obviously, you do not know how to make a good choice. So life will say, we'll take over for you. That is the exit ramp that I try not to get to, because I don't prefer to have pain in my learning situation. So have a beautiful day. Namaste. Please don't forget to look us up at www.healthymovementsinternational, or my name is Monique, M-O-N-I-E-K, Johnson.com.
Well, thank you, Monique. And once again, I'm so glad that she has these Tea Talks on YouTube. When she's live on the show, it will be, you know, new ones again. But she'll be back next week. So thank you very, very much. I always get something from her tea talks. Now, our guest is in Gwen Holdenberry from DaughtersOfIsis.com and Blog Talk Radio, Here Be Monsters. Hi, Gwen.
Hi, Ra. How are you this evening?
I am great. It's dark, and it's only a little after 7 here in Illinois. So we're going to talk about the dark of the year because, so many people, if you say the word dark, they get all excited and think that you're, I don't know what they think you're doing, but, you know, to be in balance, we must deal with the dark. And now it's been almost a month since, 3 weeks, since equinox, when the days and nights were the same length. And now is, I can tell because my cats usually try to, you know, make me get up about 4:30 or 5. And in the summertime, I could stay in bed just a little bit while they're hitting me. And it was light out, you know, a little after 5. And now it's not, I mean, I've been watching, it's about 6:45 when it gets light. And I'm not talking bright, but just light. So,
it's same down here in the tropics.
I mean, it's very hard. I don't know. I mean, I always, maybe because I grew up in a small town, my parents gardened, and I don't know. I always knew there was like a difference, and I don't remember even when I learned about equinoxes and solstices. You know, the solstice would be the summer and winter solstice when it's the shortest day of the year or the longest day. We're talking light-wise. Of course, they're all 24 hours. But recently, I think I told you that I was talking to a friend of mine who's quite bright, and I admire her so much, and she did not know what the equinoxes were, and she lives in California, and she said, well, yeah, I knew it would, you know, like it was getting dark earlier, and I always noticed that, but I didn't know, you know, why, and I was amazed. But,
well, you know, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Why is that? I mean, I learned it in school, I'm sure, but...
I think I did, too, although I will say that if when you work with indigenous or earth-based communities of or traditions of expression with spirit or even just as a walk of life, you understand that gaining an alignment, a harmony, a connection to home, the Earth Mother, is about understanding what the four quarters for her are, which are the equinox and solstices. They are the Earth calendar, if you will. That is her calendar.
Right.
So being in harmony with the planet means understanding and aligning with the balance that she's showing or the imbalance. You know, we're coming up on Samhain, on All Hallows, which is not a equinox or solstice. It's an in-betweener, and it's generally a Celt or and also Roman and Teutonic and many European traditions and ancient peoples oversaw All Hallows as the day of ancestral remembrances and calling on the ancestors and making them welcome in our lives again as guides and the spirit of a community, a revival of the spirit of a community, the anchor and history of a community.
Right. Well, and this is said to be the time when the veils between the worlds is the thinnest. So,
very thin.
Right.
No, more so than now, because we're not just between aeons or ages, we are between We are definitely between worlds. We're going from one world into a new world.
Yes.
And
I think that's why last year, this year, for several now, it's going to be that way more than ever before. Go ahead.
Well, there's just so much more. Well, the thinning of the veil is not only between the dimensions, but the thinning of the Van Allen belt and the magnetosphere that surrounds the planet has thinned too, because of the changes on the planet. And the solar and cosmic influences, those magnetic pulses that pretty much can be the cycle pumps that we respond to, or basic astrology, all of those influences are just so much more. They're tenfold, to say the least, anymore. And we have a humdinger coming up. We've got the lunar eclipse on a full moon just here a couple of days or 2 days from now.
Friday, yeah.
So it's a time of, it's on the 19th. And this full moon eclipse comes to the midpoint of the Saturn-Pluto-Uranus confabulation in the skies right now, which is very intense energy that is moving and shaking. And one of the big things it is impulsing us to do is to take charge of our own lives and who we are and how we walk.
Well, and this is, it's the perfect time, because when we're in, the dark of the year, this is when we go inward and actually work on ourselves. And so, this is all coming together.
And whether it's through the Eleusinian mysteries or in Hellenistic traditions, or it's the ancient Celtic traditions of the Druids, or people who gathered in groves, basically what we're going through is that we're acknowledging the time when we go within, and we go within in the winter anyways, but it's a symbolism of our outward life we take to our inner life. And we create, it's an extraordinarily creative time. We build our dreams during that time. And when the seasons change again and we come about, that's when we begin building the dreams. At the dark part of the year, we are assembling or creating or envisioning.
Exactly. So it's not a time to be afraid. Now a lot of people, though, they they're afraid of what they may find when they delve into themselves, and it's actually you find out. Go ahead.
Well, I do think that we all go through an initial fear in the Dionysian tradition. That would tell us a secret. And one of the secrets was that you go through a underground or cave-dwelling spook house until you come to the end where you meet the Great Spirit. And it's basically, it was always this wonderfully polished metal mirror that you were presented to yourself, you know?
Right.
In other words, saying, face yourself and know who you are. And this is, that is also a symbol of the dark part of the year.
Right. Well, and the myth a lot of people probably the European traditions, like you were talking about, use Persephone at this time of year. They'll do a ritual where she goes underground for 6 months. It's all actually, it's based really, really on the the farming communities seem to be more in touch, like you were saying, indigenous people, and maybe more than the people in the city. I think if you're out there digging in the dirt and growing things, you're more aware. I'm generalizing, of course. but...
Well, it's true. You're more in touch with these cycles, mm-hmm. and you see the symbolic reflections in them. But I think you can apply it very, very quickly to... you can apply it very quickly to any place that you would live, because there's always cycles, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's
mm-hmm.
like the sun not coming out until 6:45 in the morning now. They're experiencing that in big old New York City, too. And so the shift is basically there, you know?
If you follow that, I mean, if you get up and have your coffee and you're sitting on your veranda or whatever, I mean, you're going to notice. Now, we are talking about the Noham, because if you're in the southern hemisphere, it's just around the other way. Spring is starting, and it's lovely there. It's still a little cool, but it's getting warmer, my friends are telling me, but... Gwen and I are in the northern, and so that's what we're talking about, the dark of the year right now.
It's the planting season now down there. They will begin to plant the dreams, dreams all through the dark.
but, you know, one phrase that I've heard a lot is dark night of the soul. And I'm sure you have, too. I mean, there's been books and books and books written about it.
That's the hour of the wolf.
Yeah. Well, and people go through that. And again, so many people have saying, oh, my God, you know, like it's so horrible. And where actually it's a growing experience, because there again, you're finding out more and more about yourself, which sometimes can be a little painful at times, like you said. I mean, you know, fear and there's things in there, but it's like you come out at the other end so much more aware and much clearer than you were before, I believe.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
I think that's true. What it is facing our own inner polarities.
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
know?
Mm-hmm.
And also facing what we fear the most, you know, which is, it's got to be something that, you know, whatever it is that we're most afraid of revealing to the rest of the world.
Yeah. Some people say it's the thing that people are more afraid of than anything would be not being connected to, like the people in the Abrahamic religions would say God, others would be maybe just to spirit, to the universe. Just being totally alone, it seems to be like a major fear.
There's lots of major fears. But when they become personal, mm-hmm. from my point of view, I mean, what I've seen with people is our own failings. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not going to achieve my dreams. I'm not who I think I was or I want to be. Those kind of fears are the ones that are really the most frightening to face, you know?
Well, and those, it comes around then to people needing to maybe rearrange what their dreams were. Because that's all part of going within. Maybe something that was your dream way back, you just sort of stuck with that, but it's not really what you have wanted.
I always align it with the shamanic journey of facing the darkness within. And to me, that is about embracing what we're most afraid of revealing to the world. What's your greatest sin?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that from that point of view. And that's why the fear comes up and why people who have not faced and embraced and transformed their own inner darkness are always probably a little leery of the dark, a little leery of, you know, well, wait a minute, I don't want to go there. It takes great inner courage, and it's what the shamanic journeying is all about, because once we face our fear and embrace it and transmute it, well, then we basically, that's a gift for healing that we have to share with the rest of the community.
Mm-hmm. Because there, then you have the empathy or whatever with the others. And once you do that, it really is a life-changing journey. And that doesn't mean that it's only going to be one time, because there will be things that come up. And we always need to be soul-searching in some form or other, I believe. But there, like you said, the hardest thing, and once you make peace with it.
Yeah, well, when we embrace an inner fear like that, whatever we're afraid to reveal, when once we reveal it, once we, you know, the truth will set you free. Mm-hmm. And we transform ourselves through the process. And it takes great courage.
But, you know, the alternative to that, I think is, well, much worse. I mean, to really never know yourself or never admit who you are or whatever it is, never to do that searching out.
Well, and perhaps that's the reason that the ancient rishis and Vedics knew about, you know, reincarnation and giving ourselves the chance over and over again to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
I always go there when I'm not doing that, when I'm not facing that fear. And we all, to a certain degree, have levels of not facing something like that. Because it's the journey. It's not the destination.
No.
I think, you know, that's when you apply that. It's the journey.
Right.
It's not the destination.
Right. It's the onion again. Just peeling off the layers and layers.
Right. And now we have these wonderful tools of journeying within, where not only can we face whatever it is we fear the greatest, but that's just a breakthrough doorway for us to do past life regression work and face what were the trials before and what is my soul journey. I mean, we're living in extraordinary times as far as awareness and enlightenment goes. So the dark has several layers. The dark is a huge onion, you know?
Exactly. Like in shades that have never been seen before, metaphorically. But exactly. It's not just the black, dark of one hue. There's many tones to it, and those are the layers.
Exactly. That I would say that's exactly right. And when we find ourselves more comfortably walking in harmony with the planet, it's easier for us to walk in harmony with ourselves and our deeper natures. You know, some of us, and we are free to choose what our nature is too. We develop ourselves.
Right. Well, we develop ourselves and we develop our reality.
Yeah.
Because we're creating.
But people don't, you know, more and more people are awakening to just how doable. Could I use that word, doable?
I love doable. Yes.
Doable reality is. I really enjoy listening to Esther Hicks channel Abraham.
Abraham.
and there are several other wonderful prophets, mystics, channels out there who are bringing, essentially, there's a sameness of message. And it's about understanding that we create our world and our reality and thereby create our state of health, our finances, our where we live, what we do, how we wag in the world—it's all up to us. And it's a forgotten consciousness that we're reaching to reground or re-anchor within ourselves. I do think there was a consciousness that we held at one time on this planet that had that kind of an awareness when words really were magic, you know?
Yeah, and I love when that the phrase, forgotten consciousness. I agree. And I think, well, words still are magic.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, they are. But the do you remember the first time you learned what, you heard a word and you thought you understood it, but then the word became real to you and you understood it.
I mean, that was just like, okay, yes, I got it.
You know, one of my favorite magic words is...
What's that?
One of my favorite magic words is reciprocity.
Oh, okay, reciprocity. Right, okay.
Yeah, because it means what goes around comes around.
But it's what you give, you get. So, yes.
Yeah, it's an exactness. There's an exactness to reciprocity. It's the physics of energy. You know?
And the energy, because we know, I mean, energy is energy. It's not good, it's not bad, it's neutral, it's what we do with it. And
that's
just when
true.
Somebody is sending us a lot of bad energy, we can just take the energy because it's just energy. I mean, their intent may have been bad, but we can take the energy and turn it around, use it for whatever we want.
It's all up to us to choose.
Yes.
If we choose to learn some harsh lesson, then we do. If we choose to, I've learned this lesson enough times. I'd rather see a multicolored ball of light.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I was just going to say, I don't know quite when you came on, if you heard Monique at the end of her tea talk, when she was saying that, you know, she's doesn't want to get to a certain point because she has found she would rather learn her lessons with as little pain as possible. But she, you know, has worked on that. So,
I was hearing the end of that. It was really pretty cool.
Yeah, she's very, very good. She's done so much work on herself. And, you know, coming from an abusive family and everything, it's leaving home at an early age, she really has worked. And so she gets it. And,
yeah.
You know, it's just good. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Coming into the dark half of the year, one of my favorite things is that it's storytelling time. Traditionally, it's a time when folks would gather and tell stories. And unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know which, sometimes it's always storytelling time anymore because we have all of this wonderful media to enthrall us. But real storytelling, that's what happens during the dark of the year.
Yeah. You know, you say storytelling, and I'm immediately seeing people gathered around the campfire because, you know, everything to me goes back to gather around the campfire and tell stories all night. Yeah.
That was the ancient television, was the stories to be told around the fire.
Right, where people used like their imagination to tell and to visualize. I really like visualizing, but there's something sort of cozy about it. But I mean, it's entertaining, but there's always something to be learned from storytelling, I think.
Oh yeah, most assuredly.
Yeah, I think.
Well, that's what myth is about. It teaches us the lessons that are going to approach us in life, and it gives us a tutorial on how we might face the lessons. It's the hero's journey, you know?
Yeah.
And there are just so many different, every culture has its wonderful, beautiful hero stories that are both men and women.
Right. When it wasn't just always right, the men are the heroes and the women are, you know, dragging through whatever.
Well, hey, I think that Mother Isis was quite a hero when she went and remembered or collected the parts of Osiris and brought him back to wholeness, you know?
Yeah.
Regeneration God. Yeah. And those stories give us the templates, you know, to learn and grow by.
Mm-hmm.
And the dark half of the year is the time when those stories are collectively churning in our imaginations. I think that collective consciousness is more aligned to storytelling in the dark of the year. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I think you're right. And the collective consciousness really exists, people. We are born with certain things going on in our head, in our body. Talking about the stories, you know, a lot of what we read our children or had read to us as children, fairy tales, there's so much, if you get out of that, oh, this is a kid's story, and realize that we call them fairy tales, they weren't always called that, and they were actually stories for adults with different morals and things to them. I mean, learning things, and, you know, then it got down to the cute little picture books and everything that, you know, you read the kid before they go to bed. I didn't have some of the older, like the Grimm's fairy tales and things. My parents didn't read those to me. They were not into scary kinds of stuff for me. Consequently, I've never had a nightmare because I didn't watch those kind of shows either. And everybody else I know has nightmares sometimes, but I've never, you know, so I mean, it was...
I would call nightmares also a process of growth and great awakening.
They are. I think they are. Yeah. I mean, I've had a bad dream. But not a nightmare.
In my family, my sister and I, and even my nephew, we will get together on a weekend when he's home from school, and we'll enjoy a horror movie or two. We just enjoy that. It's a cathartic thing. My mom used to like the old Dracula movies, the old Hammer Studio movies. She used to enjoy those, and she would. I think it's a sort of a genetic thing. And I've written in college. I wrote some pretty dark, grim stories. They were really, really quite good because in the end, of course, you know, the woman or the man hero would always rise above and resolve the story with a happy ending, which is often the case with fairy tales. Although it goes to the deepest, darkest parts of us, especially with Grimm. I would interject this, too. Right now, in our current storytelling with television and movies, it's been said there's a great renaissance of storytelling going on and filmmaking and all of that. And there are stories right now on the television that are exactly like this. In fact, there's a show called Grimm that's on that's very popular. All of these polarity kind of symbolistic stories are enjoying it. And you've heard everybody, I'm sure, talking about Game of Thrones.
I saw something online about that.
Yeah,
but I don't know if I know anybody that's watching it. I don't know. I guess because this is like the modern day storytelling. Okay, the movies, the TV shows. The difference would be, you know, every few minutes is interrupted to try to sell you something, but the story.
Oh, yeah,
God.
The stories are great. Well, you know how you get around that. You DVR or record, and then you fast forward through the dang commercials. Or you go online and you watch them there, where you get a commercial at the beginning and a commercial at the end, and the only commercial you got to watch is the one at the beginning.
Right, right. That would, in my opinion, be the way to do it. The commercials.
And limit your time. But I tell you, there's quite a cornucopia of this stuff going on. In fact, I'm sure you've noticed that American Horror Story is running a witch themed season this year called Coven, and they've had
that. Yeah.
Oh, it's great! It's great. I love it. I'm deeply into it.
I know that people. Yeah, well, it's easy to do that, and I know that they're still around. True, really good storytellers, though, and I'm talking about people like you're talking Gathering Round. I heard an excellent lady several years ago at Star Wars Festival, and I can't think of her name. Nybor is her husband, the artist. She's an older lady, and she would do the stories for the kids, but, I mean, everybody gather around to hear, because she's one of those, you know, she really does a good story. And I've heard a couple other storytellers that are just amazing. I hope that art isn't lost.
Oh, gosh, no. I don't think it ever could be, Ra. I really don't.
Yeah.
I don't think it ever could be. First of all of the stuff you see on the TV or the movie, it all comes out of a book somebody's written.
Exactly. It comes from words on pages. Yeah. Either a script for TV or a movie, or from a book originally or something. So it's all been written. But there's something about just the vocal, oral storytelling that I find just wonderful. I mean, these people who can just speak, they take you into this other world with their stories. And the way they do
it. It's a gift.
It is a gift. I mean, they're real actors. It's just different kind of thing. So I would suggest, if people have never really heard one of them, look around. I mean, they are out there, and it's really worth checking them out.
You know where I run into them? I run into storytellers at drumming circles, gatherings like that are open to a community. Somebody will post on a metaphysical board or in a shop somewhere or in a center, holding a drumming circle. Anybody, just bring your drum. These are wonderful kinds of get-togethers on beaches. They're always in nature somewhere, or sometimes in a park, or a square downtown, but always inevitably. The drumming goes on, and then it's silence, and people don't want to walk away, and the stories begin.
Right, because you've already made these bonds, and it's just hard, okay, like the drummers are tired, so no, you don't just get up and take off. It's then it's just a quieter time. Yeah. And a lot of those stories, I mean, they do make you think, and that's what we're trying to say about the dark of the year. I mean, it really is a time to go inward and see who you are, find your authentic self. Not that people aren't authentic, but sometimes we've let ulterior things get in the way, or exterior things get in the way, and sort of covered up who we are. And we need to go back in and, you know, shake off all of that other and rediscover ourselves.
True.
So how would you, if somebody says, wow, okay, I'd like to, but how do I go about this? What would you suggest, Gwen?
How do I go about specifically.
Getting in touch with yourself. It's like, okay, what you guys are saying sounds good. I mean, maybe I should. It's the dark of the year. Maybe I should find out more about myself and go inward a bit. But how do I do that?
Well, you know, there's everything from, you know, psychoanalysis. Okay, we should enter the sciences here too, the mind science, or meditation is the art of healing the self by learning who you really are, and there's all kinds and forms of meditation, and when you focus on meditation, and meditation could be swimming or practicing your batting swing, or it could be sitting in a calm room and preparing it with scent and intentions and chants. There's all kinds and forms of meditation, but that is a definite going within. There's also dream journeying. You can get to know your inner self through your dreams. And dream journaling.
I was going to say, then, would you recommend keeping a dream journal?
You know, keep a notebook by your bedside and write down your dreams when you wake up in the night or in the morning, first thing, and then come back to them. There's some really wonderful books out there that will give you the symbolic meaning of symbols that are in your dreams.
Yeah. I mean, they're out there. There's tons of them. That's the only book I've ever told people, yeah, go ahead and burn it. But that's me. Because I think if you keep a dream journal long enough and you can start to see what these things mean for you.
Yeah. I give the example.
My mother was afraid of snakes. She was a little kid, and there was some blue racers around where she lived, and she was afraid of them even into her adulthood. I have had several pet snakes. I love snakes. They are my totem. I mean, if I see, or in a dream, whatever, a snake, I'm all happy. If my mother would dream about snakes, she'd have just freaked out. And
yeah, so what do they mean? What do they signify in your waking world that you should be glorifying, paying attention to, celebrating,
just the whole connection. Just like, you know, no beginning, no end kind of thing. But to my mother, that was not it. And so that's why I tell people, I mean, look at the books if you must, but, you know, I think that you are your own best interpreter.
Yes, I agree with that. I think it's also good to know what the subconscious symbolism is. There is a language of symbolism that I think dreams do use to connect that we use in dream time to speak to ourselves with.
I think so. I think that's true. And people, I wouldn't necessarily go just by what Joe Blow says. I mean, that might be for him, but not for everyone. But
right.
I think that we have some people, like Jung, who has studied and, you know, put some names and faces to things, that it wouldn't hurt to see what he, with collective unconscious, what he come up with.
One of his students, a guy who studied Jung for many years and did a lot of work with dreams, and subconscious symbolism and such. His name was Tony Crisp, and he wrote an A to Z dream dictionary. And he not only used Jungian, but he also translated old cultural meanings and symbolism into it too. He decanted so much, and it's a paperback. It's like a Tony Crisp. I use that one. There's some really good ones out there, but if I'm like sort of befuddled in the morning, generally speaking, my grandmother was a precog dreamer. She was very powerfully good at that. And she would dream all kinds of crazy stuff, but she knew what it meant when she woke up.
Right.
She knew exactly how it translated into the world real around her. And
yeah.
She knew things. I mean, she was about the child across the street who was not going to come home and the mother was going to get the telephone. You know, she knew things too. But, you know, she was a precognitive dreamer. And when you're exact at that, when you hit the nail on the head that way, it becomes a part of your life big time.
Sure.
It's mediumship of a kind. Anyway.
It is mediumship, yeah.
I used to dream about a dragon when I was young, and I knew when I woke up that there was something very, very bad and frightening going to happen. And this was when I was around 6 years old, and I knew all of a sudden when I woke up to that my father was dead, and those kind of things. And so, you know what I did when I realized this is really crazy. When I realized it's like I closed the barn door after the horse got out, and I've been trying to open it back wide again. I bought a golden dragon. My mother was ill, and I knew it. I knew it. I dreamt. I was uneasy, but I didn't dream the dragon. And I feared it something awful because I dreamt the dragon 3 times as a child between 6 and 7. And my father, my grandmother, and my mom almost died. You know, so that dragon to me was the symbol of great chaos and death. And when I would awaken from the dream of the dragon, and I don't know where it came from either, but I was a big fan of Camelot and King Arthur and all of that, so perhaps that's where it came from. But so when my mother actually was very ill and I just knew it, I went out and I bought a beautiful little golden dragon charm. And my best friend was my editor in those days. I was working on a newspaper in North Carolina. And I gave the dragon to my editor and I said, please take my dreams. I don't want them. Please, and understand I'm giving you something you might not want to take. So after a few hefty belts of George Dickel, we agreed that she took the dragon. and I didn't have the dream, but it didn't matter because I knew, of course. But the thing is that the symbolism for you, it could be, and the dragon is a serpent, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Great wisdom and great courage and great wealth the dragon symbolizes. Just wonderful stuff with a dragon, but also can be very, very frightening and very, very, you know, changing, like a tower card in the tarot deck. That's symbolism.
It was good that you mentioned that the cards and things, because a lot of people, when they're doing this inward journey, they work with cards or runes or something like that.
Yes.
Along with the dream. I mean, there's many tools like that you can.
Yeah, and if you're going to work with tarot, it's best to stay with the major arcana to work with symbolism instead of the complete deck. Because you're going to get more succinct symbolism there. Are we at the top of our hour?
We are.
We do that.
Yes, when Gwen and I talk, we talk. Gwen, thank you very, very much. And have a happy lunar full moon, lunar eclipse full moon.
Right. Yes, and walk with joy. Walk with joy in this.
Always. Moment. Exactly. And also, enjoy
the
south. I love October.
Me too.
Thank you so much, Gwen.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you, Ra.
DaughtersOfIsis.com and also Here Be Monsters right here on Blog Talk Radio. My goodness, I don't even know what's going on. Yeah. So, yes, on Blog Talk TV. Well, that's just because I was watching Brian, my host on Progress Toward Democracy. There's
yes,
a YouTube video. We've been putting that around. He's talking about hedge funds and things that sometimes people may roll their eyes, but Brian can make it something you understand. So, private equity and hedge funds. And check out our pages because we posted it, our walls. So thank you again, Gwen, so much.
You're welcome, Ra, and I'll be talking to you soon.
Exactly, we will.
All righty, darling.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, hello.
Hi there. How are you doing?
I am great. Dorit Jacobson is here, and we're going to talk about Palestine, one of our favorite topics, huh, Dorit?
Yes.
At least we're working toward the freedom in Palestine. So what has been going on in Israel this week and in Palestine?
It doesn't look too good this week. If you go on the Israeli groups as a Hebrew speaker, it looks like they're not even talking about Palestine. So
really?
I try to.
Well,
yeah,
what,
they're talking about the poverty
mind?
And the austerity.
Isn't that?
Yeah. So
we never see that here. Nobody here is, you know, saying, "Oh boy, those poor Israelis. You know, they're starving to death." Or because
they are.
I know, but it's not part of the mainstream media here.
They're looking for food in the trash. Old people, young people, educated people. It's just insane. The poverty is on the rise. The big sufferers of it are actually women because we get paid less.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I looked at the charts. It looks like we get paid there less than, like it's worse than in the United States. I know in the United States it's 15% less or something,
30%. Oh, okay. Oh, that much? Okay, because I thought that the women in the United States were making something like 70% of what a man makes, which would
be... Oh, maybe you're right. Well, in Israel it's like double than that,
see,
it seems.
My sisters are old, but in Israel then it's even worse.
Yes.
Oh.
There's more people have joined the poverty, 90,000 people.
And now, people might say, well, 90,000 is not so much. But yes, it is, because Israel doesn't have that many million people. I mean, so that's a lot.
It's tiny. It's New Jersey. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So you put people like that, okay, there's poverty now. Is there any kind of, you know, in a lot of countries, even... whatever, even the countries that the U.S. is fighting against, there's different kinds of either UN or other international organizations that are trying to give money or food. Is there anything like that going on in Israel? Or is it, if there isn't, is it because the government won't admit that there's a problem?
The government won't even admit that there is a problem, and you know what's funny? Their president sounds just like Obama in one way. He always like the middle class this, the middle class that.
Yeah.
But what about the poor people? What about the working class?
Yeah.
They're always talking about the middle class there.
Right. And maybe the middle class. I mean, I don't know, because here we're fast losing the middle class. I mean, there is the middle class, but... like people who are not big, wealthy corporations, but yet, like I'm thinking of where I live, not far from here, there's a factory that hires, 150 people maybe, where everybody around here at one time or another has worked there. But, I mean, they're so horrible to their employees. People don't stay very long, but...
Yes, I know in Israel they're horrible to their employees because my friend was crying after work from how mean they were.
Yeah, yeah. I've worked jobs like that. I mean, they're just horrid, but yet, you know, they would consider themselves middle class, and they are, because they're not working for poverty wages. I mean, they're making money off the backs of the people who are working for poverty wages.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're still not, I mean, they're definitely not elite or anything. I mean, they are the middle class, but other people are just stretching. But so if the government there doesn't, I mean, how are these people getting by? Or are the, if they're weak
they're
enough?
They're protesting right now. There's a protest right now. I'm seeing it live on their live feed. People are not getting by. We had, for example, a mother, that was a few months ago, but I never talked about it. A mother went in a town called Be'er Sheva to get a little help from Social Security because she was a single mother. Apparently the help wasn't good enough. She tried to light herself on fire. Luckily they caught it on time and didn't let her burn.
Well, but then did you ever find out what happened? I mean, like, were her children taken away from her, or are they all starving now?
I don't think they would take her children away, no.
No?
They're not,
okay.
They will take children away there, but it's not as easily as here, I think.
Oh, okay, okay. Yeah. But how can, I mean, just to come to that state of despair, it's...
Yes.
That's just horrible to say, well, they left and they had a few of people do that months, maybe it was last year in Spain, older people who just had all the benefits, I mean, because of austerity taken away and all, and they were self-immolating. That's every time somebody mentions that, I think about the monks in Tibet. You know,
I wish people would stop doing it because it doesn't seem to work anymore.
Well, no, I mean it's got to be just a horrible, 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 painful death, and it doesn't. I mean, they're trying to draw attention to things, and remember, the young man in Tunisia actually got Arab Spring started doing that.
Was great, yeah.
Right, that was, I mean, you know, I can't think of his name right now, and I should be able to, but I can't, you know, it's such a horrible way to get something going. And like you said, this woman, this mother, nobody, you know, they just passed it by, and they saved her life, but you didn't hear about it in the wide media.
And they also have they're very similar to United States. They have a very similar rape culture going on. I'm noticing. A man raped a 14-year-old. It was a family member, like a niece. He got 5 years.
Five years.
We don't think that's enough.
Well, no.
We think that's ridiculous.
Well, it is ridiculous. And if it's like
and the rabbi knew about it and didn't talk. There was a rabbi that knew about it the whole time. He didn't talk about it. And luckily the newspaper is talking about that.
Okay, well, I hope that, yeah. I mean, the rabbi is supposed to take care of people. But you know what? The
exactly.
Man got 5 years, three. If it's anything like the United States, he'll be out in two. It's just...
Yeah, he will. It's just like United States. And I try to go in these groups and talk about the occupation. Sometimes their reactions make me angry, just contaminated with so much racism and stupidity. Today I found out their minister of money, finance, doesn't know what opposition means. He was blaming that, you know, and the Knesset, they have an opposition. He was blaming them of being traitors. It sounded like a stupid, stupid, stupid person.
Dad,
no reason.
Have the opposition. What's he? Okay, he's
He gave like billions to foreign corporations, and they're mad at him, so he's attacking them back.
Okay. Well,
all the money that's supposed to be for the people is going to corporations. As they do to them, they will do to you. Seems like Israelis and Palestinians are both suffering very much there.
Yeah. Well, like you've mentioned before here, the money that Germany is sending that's supposed to go to the people who are left from the Holocaust in Germany.
Absolutely.
Isn't getting.
And they're not seeing anything. They're starving.
They're part of the people that are in the garbage cans looking for food.
Exactly. And you know what? I saw an interview, and you know what the lady said? She said, "Oh, it's okay. I'm used to starving. I'm used to going to bed hungry." That was sad for me to see that.
That's horrible. I mean,
made me sad.
You know, no one on this planet should ever have the opportunity to say that, because we have enough to feed everyone. It's not being allocated right because people are stealing it. People are doing whatever.
Especially in the Mediterranean, where everything grows on trees. There's grapes. You just get lost in the woods and you find grapes and figs. It's not like you're in Alaska.
That would be. And
yeah.
That's,
it happened to me. I found a whole bunch of things. I was hungry, lost in my walk, and I found everything I needed to eat.
That sounds like a paradise. It sounds wonderful. I know the olive
is
this month in Palestine.
Yes, and on Friday, if internationals would like to come to Israel and help the Palestinians pick up olives and be human shields, we need as many to come there, by the way.
In Berlin or where?
To Israel. We need people to come to
Israel and be human
shields.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. They can contact me or Tayush. Tayush is the name of the organization that is bringing the human shields. Because if you don't have human shields, they will be attacked by the settlers, and it's very sad.
I mean, I just can't imagine what it would be like to have these people come in, take over your land, and, you know, the children can't even walk to school sometimes in the West Bank without the IDF, without the Israeli Defense Forces or occupation forces. They have Israeli soldiers marching the kids the Palestinian kids to school because the settlers, also known as squatters, are abusive.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They call them names and all. So, I mean, how messed up is this? I mean,
it sounds a lot like Kashmir. I was listening to the conversation you had about Kashmir. It's the same. It may not be as many soldiers to people. I heard it's a very high number of soldiers to people.
But
the idea is the same of dehumanizing them, not seeing them as human, and not caring about them as a life.
Exactly.
It's
and putting them in jail for no reasons and not letting them see their families. The families don't even know if they're dead or alive. Yeah.
Yes.
It's the same. It was somebody, it was a Kashmiri, who was on a Palestinian group or a list or something, who first found me a few years ago and started telling me about Kashmir. He said, we have a lot of the same things going on. And, you know, as far as being occupied and in this concentration camp. And, yeah, Kashmir's got 700,000 occupying Indian soldiers in it. So it's... And it's a much bigger area than Palestine, and it has a lot more people in it. But yeah, we had figured out it's not as much as, but it's one soldier to every 20 or less people. So
that's insane.
That is something, and. But in Palestine, they're having the olive harvest, and all these olive trees are being burned and cut down and all that the squatters do. So this is a livelihood for people. I mean, what do you do when
Absolutely.
Your life is gone? A friend of mine in Gaza, his grandparents used to have an orange grove, but that was destroyed. And, what do you do when that's the way you make your living? And then you're,
they
you
are
know,
pushing them to violence. That is how the Zionist regime pushes
exactly.
them to
yeah.
it.
They're trying so
Even
hard.
A nonviolent human, I was talking to the Madison police about this subject, and the Madison police officers thought that Israel is pushing them to violence. And police knows what pushing to violence is.
They
we have good police here.
That's what you guys said that they're good down there in your part of Tennessee you do have, but sure you can just take the
no one would agree to be kicked out of their home for no reason just because God
exactly.
said that home belongs to you
exactly
so.
and have your animals poisoned the water supply your animals die all that
no
kind
I love
of-
my animals.
No, really.
It's insane.
Nobody's going to, just smile and say, okay, just go ahead, put my 5-year-old in jail. It's okay. So of course they're pushing. And I have just been amazed as Palestinians who just have been so calm about this.
I know. And, I don't know how they keep their cool like that. They have no choice.
They just want peace. You see, we all lived together before, and why can't we do it again?
Of course, that's
our question. Because that, as long as Israel has those Zionist politicians, it's just not going to happen.
All over the U.S. government, I'm noticing Jewish names in the politicians, and I know that they work for AIPAC.
Well, they do.
Because, every police officer here even trains with Israelis or something. They're all
Why the hell?
I know. I talk to the police a lot. I like our police here. They talk. We can talk.
We should talk. Exactly. Because then, it'd be harder for them to fire on us when the government says...
We need to wake them up. Someone needs to wake up the police.
Right.
And they're not dumb. Not here.
No. I mean,
very smart. I'm impressed.
Some are like the population dumbed down, but a lot of them, are on the ball, and they feel like they're stuck also because they don't.
Oh yeah.
They know how jobs are. It's hard to get a job, and some of the cops really got into it because they wanted to help people. Okay. I mean, some of them really had good intentions, and they don't know. If I quit this job, can I get another job? What would I do? And they're having trouble even making ends meet now. So
they do.
I know
that.
They're just humans. But you said a lot of Israeli names in the U.S. government. There's over, and this is probably a year or so ago, there were over 200 politicians out of the House and representatives, the Senate and the House, in the U.S. government who had dual citizenships with Israel.
How many?
There was something like 200.
So they're the ones who shut down this government because they don't like Obama talking with a guy from Iran on the phone. I mean, the president.
Well, yeah, see, that's enough to throw a lot of them in whatever.
Sure, because they still want the war with Iran over there. It's all over their mainstream media.
Yes, they do. Sure. Well, there's money.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's money in it for the companies, and the companies give them money. So, and then remember when somebody leaves Washington as a representative or senator, they go to work for a lobbyist. And
yes.
I'm with some people who say, well, there should be at least 10 years before they can work for any, they can't be a lobbyist for 10 years at least once they leave electoral office, and I agree.
Forever.
Forever.
Yeah.
But at least 10 years. But yeah, I mean, so we have so many things that are just too bizarre. It's
we had internationals arrested in Hebron for being human shields.
Okay, yeah.
I'm just warning you guys. They probably will not be to you, but it won't be fun.
Right, yeah. We want you to come and be human shields, but we also want you to know that you may be arrested, and chances are you will be arrested.
Yes.
So the internationals that come and do this, there again, we're talking heroes.
There's always internationals and the same bunch of Israeli people who are not afraid of tear gas and rubber bullets. Some are afraid and doing their activity without going there.
Yeah. Well, so, like we know the rubber bullets, I mean, they can put your eyes out and everything. Just because it's a rubber bullet doesn't mean that it's not going to harm you. It's not.
Yeah, they're very harmful.
Yeah, yeah. I know some people say, well, it's just a rubber bullet. Well, we're not talking about a beach ball here that, you know, or something like that, a little cute little ball that you throw, whatever. I mean, we're talking about a bullet with that force. And so, no, they're very dangerous. And
October 12, we had an attack on internationals.
Okay, the 12th was Saturday.
Oh, Saturday. A group of settlers surrounded the entrance of a family property, built a wire fence to block the exit, and they attacked the internationals. I'm so sorry to be the bad news.
That's not unusual, though. I mean, the internationals get attacked. It's just, you know.
They're not safe there.
No, no. And I'm surprised.
But it's the right thing to do.
Well, it's the right thing to do. But I'm surprised that Israel lets them in when they fly in.
Oh, it tries not to. It tries not to, and it has a special jail for they will ask for your Facebook password.
Right.
If you're in ISM or something.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're going to go out, you need to close your Facebook account.
Oh, yeah.
All of that, if you're going to go. Yeah. I mean, and, you know, go ahead and get one with some other name if you want, whatever. But, yeah, I've heard that they will ask for that. So.
Yeah. It's so insane. They say they can do whatever they want. There's no law there.
Right.
Every once in a while, the settlers will build on private Palestinian land and the high court in Israel will kick them out, and then they get angry and vandalize some homes or cars or trees or animals or people, whatever they can do.
Right. Yeah, once in a while, it's just like somebody in the high court actually has a little glitch of consciousness. Consciousness, and they say, oh, okay, this is bad. But usually it's like, go ahead, build, you know, go ahead, steal the land. And like you said, so many crimes that are committed by the soldiers and everything, they're never brought to court. They're never even arrested.
Not really, no. It's the norm.
Yeah.
And for that, there is Breaking the Silence, an organization of Israeli soldiers, Breaking the Silence. Today there's a new testimony of soldiers that's saying their officer says, I want bodies, that's what I want. That's the attitude.
That was what their officer, he didn't care. Just
want bodies, that's what I want.
Bodies.
It's a book. There's a book about it. A new book came out, Our Harsh Logic, Israeli Soldier Testimonies.
What was that, how current you think, when he said, I want bodies, would that have been like during Operation Cast Lead or something?
Let's see.
Or would it just be... just
during Cast Lead, I know that happened, yes. Lead was a very, very immoral war. Those who've been there wouldn't admit to it. But
oh,
the
really?
Testimonies are really bad. Yeah, I've spoken to some people in Israeli groups who won't admit to it and lie.
Oh.
But I want bodies full of bullets, and if we come back with someone we'd killed, he was happy. That's how it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's and see, I mean, that's horrible. But then you go back to what happened with this country in probably every war they've ever been in, and they've been in for since the country began. But I'm thinking of what we've heard about Vietnam. That's what they would do there too. They wanted
exactly.
They wanted, and it didn't matter. Women, children, whatever, body counts, and. War is
terrible.
Such a dehumanizing thing. It's they're never fought, at least any war the United States has ever fought since they won their independence, and then I guess the War of 1812. But from there on, any other war they've been involved in, it was never, ever for democracy. It was never, well, to keep our freedom. It was never that.
People from Gaza say Hamas is not really their government. It's that some of them say that Israel put them there.
I've heard that, but then other people say, well, they have mistakes,
yeah.
But they're better. At least it seems like Hamas is more for the people than
They give the people food or something.
The Palestinian Authority. Abbas has a rough job, okay? He does. I mean, anybody who's a leader of a country or a section, whatever, it can be rough, but he seems to really work with Israel against the Palestinians in many cases. And just like the police force, the Palestinian police force, I hear so much that they actually they work against the other Palestinians because they're working more for Israel. And I don't know how true that is, but if it's true.
I know Israel uses a lot of Palestinians, forces them to work for them with threats to their family and children.
Yeah, can you?
I saw testimonies of that.
Now,
it's
a lot of
disgusting, dirty occupation.
Right. Is a lot of this in breaking the silence? If we go to break the silence.
That one, actually, I will send you the link of the Palestinian man talking about this. It's from a girl named Tamar. She works in Checkpoint Watch.
Oh.
Group of Israeli women who go to checkpoints and report what is happening there. And I was reading how they make people wait a few hours in their ambulances and don't care.
See, so then you're going to die on the way, whatever. Golly, we've only got 2 minutes. Next week, we have Ahmed Baker in Palestine, and he's going to be talking about, he's in the West Bank, he's in Ramallah, and he's going to be talking about what it's like there. So.
Oh, yeah.
That'll be on our show. That'll be right ahead of you. I think that Blaine is taking a few weeks off, evidently, because his phone is messed up, and I'm not sure what that's about. So we'll expect you back at 8 o'clock next week. And
great. And I will send the link of the guy that says that you have to work for them or else.
Right. Yes,
you'll
too.
Be shocked. Yes. It has English subtitles. I'm glad.
Oh, okay. And I'll put it on Air Marte Fio, the page.
Yes.
And I'll also put it on my wall and put it around. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
Please do. And Sarit, thank
and
you
I,
so much. Because you always have
anytime.
Stuff to tell us, and it's things that we really need to know. We really need to keep in mind. So thank you, my friend, and I'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Okay.
See you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.